Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here with us and honored to be able to move the conversation forward to the next level of understanding these amazing, amazing principles. And I was talking to someone recently that triggered a desire to cover a particular topic on the show, so I want to open that one up. And as I was speaking to someone who was someone who's been involved in doing their work for many years and is a pretty high-level therapist. And I had responded to a post that they had put up, and they were talking about the idea of something making you feel. How did that, basically the question was, how did that make you feel? And there's a whole complex of information that goes into creating this thing called perception in the mind, a construct that shows us not necessarily what's true about what's happening in the world, but what's true about what we believe is happening in the world. And because those two things can be very literally diametrically opposed, depending on the language that we use, I just want to bring forward once again a reminder of the power of words. And if you listen to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, he says the power of life and death is in your words. You might remember your mother saying something to you like, as mine did, choose your words carefully. One day you may need to eat them. And there was wisdom in that. And so I want to kind of start out with a basic idea and then develop it from there, just to kind of cover that whole topic. You might want to do a search on YouTube, and there's a TED Talk done by a man named Anil, A-N-I-L-S-E-T-H. Anil Seth is a neuroscientist at, if I remember correctly, University of Sussex in England. And what Neil offers to us is the understanding that perception, the world we see, the construct of our mind is nothing more than a construct. It is the mind's best guess based on what's resonated within it, its best guess about what is actually happening outside of it. But they're two different things. Now, the best we can hope from perception is that the information that's used to develop it is true and accurate, and therefore our perception gives us something true about what's happening in the world. But the offering here is, if perception is coming from the mind, that even if everything it tells us about the world of actuality is true, it's still just a reality in our minds. So reality is a construct in the mind. Actuality is what actually happened. If our reality is 100% accurate, it's still just a reality in the mind. It is not what actually happened in the world. And my offering is that you don't have actual life until you are actually interacting with what's actually going on in the world. And I know that's a lot of actualies. But while we're in perception, even if it is accurate, it's not the experience. We're not directly experiencing the energy of what's happening in the actual world. And we have faculties to do that. It's just not the mind that gives that to us. So recognizing that reality is a construct, an important piece of understanding how those constructs are made comes from understanding the power of language in structuring our perception, the world we see. We've talked many times about the Harvard research in the realm of psychology that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity happening in the brain, the max amount of data that goes into constructing your perception is 9 bits. Very, very tiny fragment of what's moving in your mind, and certainly a much tinier fragment of what's moving in the actuality. The time frame for those numbers of 10,000 bits being measured, 10,000 units of electrical activity being measured, and 9 bits of that, 9 fragments of that being what structures our reality, is about a 25th of a second. And it's been estimated, and I don't know that anyone's ever been able to or could ever actually tell us what the truth of it is, but it's been estimated that in that same time frame, there may be as much as 20 trillion bits of data happening in the actuality, in the actual world that's in front of you. So let's just accept that number. It might be a half of that. It might be 20 times that. I don't know. I don't know that we have a way of measuring it with our, you know, we're kind of like an ant trying to measure the height of that radio tower over there. How do we do that? But let's just go with 20 trillion bits. The mind is kind of like a reducer valve, reduces it down to 10,000 bits. And then the next level of reduction is to our perceptual construct is 9 bits. The key becomes what determines which 9 bits of information your mind selects out of the perhaps 20 trillion or the 10,000. What information does your mind select to form that 9-bit construct in your mind? And what directs that process? Well, number one, the driver, the overall driver for that process is goals. And let's talk about this in familiar terms of where there is upset. So you'll notice that, unless you're a generally miserable person, you're pretty happy with everybody who's doing everything that you want them to do. Everybody that is in a reasonable way fulfilling all the goals you have for them. And you'll notice that you're only pointing upset at them when they're not fulfilling the goal that you have for them. And our goals, by and large, are formulated out of words. So words instruct the mind what data it is allowed to use to generate its construct, your perception. Words either allow or inhibit certain information from being used. So once you recognize that the only thing that can cause you to feel is an energy that's moving inside of you, you know, aside from cancel the thought, a punch in the nose, feelings are internal. They come from within. Emotions are internal. They come from within. And the words we use to tell our minds how to structure our understanding of what we're feeling are really important, because those words can either inhibit or will allow or will cause the mind to hallucinate information about what's happening and give us either a relatively accurate or a totally false perception. Let's take the person who's in a deep state of somnambulism, a deep hypnotic state. And we've all seen it, this person standing on the stage. And standing on the stage, words are fed into this person's mind, and hypnosis is nothing but the uncritical acceptance of an idea fed with words into the mind of the person standing on the stage, the person is hypnotized, and we say to that person, you are now on the bow of a ship. And literally, this person looks down at the stage that a moment before was just a stage, but now that they've uncritically accepted the idea that they're on the bow of a ship, when they look down at the stage, the brain, because the words interrupted the natural flow of information, you know, there's a stage, light energy bounces off of the stage, hits my eye, feeds information to my brain perceives I'm standing on a stage. But if the hypnotist intervenes and says you're standing on the bow of a ship, then literally what the mind does is it produces the hallucination of living on the bow or standing on the bow of a ship. Literally, this person looks at the stage and does not see a stage, but they see the bow of a ship. So that's an hallucinated reality. And if you've ever seen, you know, up close, somebody in hypnosis, it's very, very real to them, even though it never happened and it isn't there. It can be very disturbing and upsetting if the hypnotist tells them that's what's going on, or it can be very wonderful and pleasing. If you listen to the ancients, when they said transcend, they weren't saying float off in space somewhere. They were saying put an end to the state of trance. Get out of hypnosis. Most people live most of their lives in a state of hypnosis, in a lie. And their perception shows them that the lie is true. Now, there's nothing true about standing on the bow of a ship for the person who's on stage being told by a hypnotist you're standing on the bow of a ship, but that doesn't change the fact that their construct, the mind's construct, shows them standing on the bow of a ship. If I feed incorrect words to my mind, my mind has this ability to turn my words into pictures. You're on the bow of a ship, and sure enough, the mind turns that into pictures. Now, if I speak accurately about, let's say, a painful emotion that I have, then my accurate speech is going to be, well, you know, this event happened in the world, and what that resonated in me was this particular quality of pain. And when I speak those words accurately to my mind, I've given my mind permission to show me that this pain is something that comes from inside of me and belongs to me. But if I speak inaccurate words, and my words are a desire to deny and not own what's happening in me, and I say, you made me really suffer by the hurt you inflicted on me when you did whatever it was that you did, my mind will then generate for me a construct. And remember, when you're looking at 10,000 brain cells firing and only 9 bits of data, you're looking at evidence. And words are the primary thing that give the mind permission to show certain evidence. So when I say to my mind, you really hurt me when you did that, I've said to my mind, mind, structure for me a construct where I get to see that Bill over there is the cause of my hurt. And my mind will literally build me a construct, a 9-bit picture, where I see Bill as the cause of my hurt, and I really will see it and experience it that way. That's the power of words in the evidential mind. And the reason I'm talking about this is, and, you know, as I say, I was interacting with someone who's been involved in this work for some time and is a fairly high-level therapist, but still talking about how did that make you feel? My offering is that we need to give up the fallacy that anything outside of us can cause us to feel anything. Again, aside from a punch in the nose. You get a punch in the nose, you're going to have some, you know, experiences in there. But, you know, we talk to somebody on the phone who's on the other side of the world and we rage at them for causing all this pain in us. It's like, how could somebody on the other side of the world speaking into a little piece of plastic and metal with a glass face on it cause air molecules to move because of the way they vibrate their voice box, and those air molecules cause a little plastic thing called a microphone to vibrate back and forth, and that vibration of the microphone is converted into an electrical frequency that then is inserted into a signal that travels from the other side of the world through the air, through electronic waves, through technology. And there's an antenna just down the road. That frequency is broadcast by that antenna. And I have another little with a glass face on it and a little plastic cone in it called a speaker. And that electrical frequency that came out of that person's mouth on the other side of the world resonates and fires with a similar frequency here in my phone. And I think I hear that person saying words. And I say, your words really upset me. I mean, how silly is it that someone vibrating their voice box on the other side of the world because a little piece of plastic in this thing I call a telephone vibrates, that they caused me to be upset? I mean, it's just pure silliness. So my offering is that giving up that fallacy that anything can cause us to feel anything, and recognize that all that the outside world can show us is what's already within us. So if somebody on the other side of the world vibrated their voice box, telephone broadcast a signal, signals decoded by my phone and comes back to me, I need to recognize that my emotions are a part of perception. And that my emotions are a reflection of something that's going on inside of me. It's an internally generated construct of my mind. And if I don't like its effect on me when it moves in me, by telling you that you're the reason I'm experiencing this, I leave a whole step out of what's happening in my mind and in my structure where this energy is stored that I'm feeling the effects of. If you can do me the favor of showing me some sort of emotional pain that I have in me and I can actually own it, then you've given me the opportunity to recognize I've got something stored in me that is causing pain, which means, in effect, it doesn't belong in me. And so now I have the opportunity to heal that. I have the opportunity to remove that. I have the opportunity to forgive that energetic pattern in me, remembering that forgiveness has nothing to do with me letting you off the hook for what's happening inside of me, but that forgiveness is a piece of technology with which you go inside yourself and you collapse the world of false perception. And you get to access directly the underlying energy that's stored in you that's causing you to feel. Now, that's a huge blessing, unless you live in denial. And denial leads to deepening disease. And I'm speaking of the specific definition of denial that we've developed in this work, which is whenever I think or speak, and so something outside of me is the cause of something moving inside of me, then I'm in denial. You know, in order to play the blame game and believe that my lie, that something or someone outside is a cause for what's happening inside of me, I've got to hide the real cause of it from me. I've got to hide the energy that's moving in me and hallucinate a construct that paints for me a picture of a world that shows me that you're the problem, that you're the reason I'm feeling this, rather than the reason I'm feeling this is because it's inside of me. Now, the problem with that whole game of denial, thinking or speaking as though something outside is the cause of what's moving inside means that each time I enter into denial, I successfully hide the cause of what's really going on. And hiding that is called dissociation. If I dissociate from the cause of something in me, I now no longer have access to that which is moving in me, or the cause of that which is moving in me, and I cannot remove it. I cannot apply forgiveness to it because my mind won't show me that it's mine, and therefore I cannot access it directly. I'll always remain in that dissociated state. So I've created now, through denial, through this pretense, through this cultural idea that you're the cause of what's moving in me, I've created an unnatural internal condition. I've created an unconscious mind. And my offering is that we are not designed as human beings to have an unconscious mind. How far are we away from our natural state? Well, if you talk to the psychologist today, they'll tell you that perhaps as much as 90 or 95 or maybe even 98% of what's moving in your mind is unconscious. So how far are we away from our natural condition? Well, if 98% of what's going on in our minds is unconscious, we're a long way from condition where we're not designed to have anything unconscious in us. We should be able to access and touch into anything that's moving in us at any time. But if we push down that energy through denial, you made me mad, you made me sad, you hurt me, you upset me, you disturbed me. When I do that, I'm pushing down and refusing to access what's true in me. Which means I'm going to increase the discomfort wherever that energy is stored in tissue, and because relative to any particular part of my tissue, if it's causing pain, it's causing pain because it's of a disintegrative nature. It's not designed to be there. So when I recognize that this pain is signaling me that there's something inside of me that doesn't belong in me, then I have the opportunity to access, if I'm willing to move out of that unconscious state, and remove what never belonged. The process of removing, of accessing and removing what never belonged in you is called forgiveness. Notice the Greeks turned around and showed us or gave us a totally and completely backward definition of forgiveness, one that's consistent with living in a world of denial. You know, notice how much the world time spends in you made me. I'm only upset because of you. It's what you did that disturbed me. So when I refuse to own what's going on in me, what do I have to do? I have to push on it. I have to push it down and push it out of sight. But each time I push it out of sight, I add energy to that pattern. What it does is it assures that it's going to repeat in my life. It's going to give me that why is this happening to me again experience. If you haven't read the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again Yet? Unfortunately, we can't sell you one because it's out of print. However, you can go to Amazon or eBay, and there are always lots of used copies there. Fortunately, a quarter of a century ago, we spread enough copies of that book around the country that there's still lots of them hanging around in Amazon, eBay, and other used bookstores. Or you're welcome to go to our website, whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And if you go there and you click on the book cover, you can go in and download the book in any one of, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 9 languages. And Jeannie was telling me that we just had someone the other day that's volunteering to translate the book into Polish. So we'll have, hopefully before too long, another language. So the book is there, and it details this "why is this happening to me again" game. You know, we're just doing a brief picture of it here. But ultimately, what forgiveness does, it allows me to collapse the world of false perception that's based on the lies I tell myself. Lies like, you made me mad, you made me sad, you hurt me, you upset me, it's your problem. You know, if they're the one with the pain, why am I, or with the problem, why am I the one with the pain? Something about that doesn't make sense. Good question to ask yourself. If they're the one with the problem, why am I the one with the pain? If you have pain and you think it's somebody else's problem, you've really got a problem. And it's your opportunity to learn to access that energy in yourself and remove its influence from your life. So if I never deal with, if I never remove that energy, then over and over again, someone is going to show up that's going to resonate that in me. Well, why would somebody show up to resonate that in me, Michael? Because that's what governs the world, the law of resonance. It's a law of energy exchange. In its simplest form, if I take a middle C tuning fork and I put it in front of a second middle C tuning fork, I hit that first one on the desk and get it vibrating really hard. I put it in front of the second middle C tuning fork. The second middle C tuning fork starts to move. That's what resonance does. It creates motion. And in the human realm, resonance creates motion towards. Someone's going to show up that matches whatever you hold within you. And the more you try to push it down, the more you put energy into it. You know, I like to use an example of, let's imagine that I've got a 3-foot diameter spring that stands 3 feet high. And here it is on the floor. Can that spring do anything just sitting there on the floor? Can it create motion? Can it go anywhere? No, absolutely not. But what happens if I go over and I push on that spring and lock it down? Now there is potential energy stored in that spring. And what if I push on it again and again and again and again and again, and I spend my whole life saying things like, you made me mad, you made me sad? That language means that you're pushing down that spring in yourself every time you say that or think that. What happens if after decades of that, I take the lock off of that spring and all that potential energy becomes kinetic and bang, it flies off into space? Well, one of the fortunate things I got to do back about 40 years ago, it was over a period of several years, I was invited to speak, to do keynote addresses at a conference called Global Sciences. And one year, a gentleman named Marcel Vogel, absolute sweetheart of a man, genius, was speaking at the conference as well. And what Marcel did, Marcel was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM, absolute genius. He's a guy that at the age of 11 invented chemical light. You know, if you go to a football game or what have you, you buy a light stick, and it's a plastic tube, and in it there's some glass rods or what have you. You bend it and you break the glass rods inside and the two chemicals mix and all of a sudden it lights up. Marcel invented that at the age of 11. And because his family didn't have the money, he patented it at the age of 11 personally. The only reason that you are able to utilize the computer that you use or the phone that you use is Marcel invented the magnetic coating that allows your hard drive to operate. That's the kind of mind Marcel had. So Marcel, this particular year, brought a thing with him to the conference called a Delaware camera and explained how he had used this camera to take a picture of the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. Now, the camera's a little different than your standard camera that, you know, when you click the button, it opens the aperture and light energy comes in and is registered on the photographic plate. Between the lens and the photographic plate, aside from the shutter, there's a tuning mechanism so that you can tune the camera so that only certain energies are picked up when the lens is opened. And they're the energies that reflect onto the photographic plate. If you tune it properly, for instance, and I've seen the pictures, they take a picture of an oak tree, or pardon me, they take a picture of an acorn, and what shows up on the photographic plate is an oak tree. Now, on first thought, most people go, oh, come on, Michael, now isn't that just getting a little ridiculous? It's like, well, if you understand the world and physics and how it works, you know, I'm in a room right now. I'm not listening to one radio station. I don't have the TV turned on. But, you know, invisible to me right now, there are probably 1,000 different television stations and who knows, 10,000 different radio stations that are in this room with me right now. All I need is the decoding mechanism, the tuner, to attune to it, and I can be listening to that station. It's here. Now my senses say, no, that's ridiculous. I go over and I take a knife and I cut the acorn up into 1,000 pieces and I say, that's ridiculous, oak tree in here. But think about it logically. If you've ever planted an acorn, or if you've planted acorns repeatedly over the years, what you've noticed is that every time you plant an acorn, you get an oak tree. You don't get corn. You don't get a new Mercedes. You don't get a Volkswagen or an apple tree. You get an oak tree. Now, obviously, in the same way that these radio stations and these television stations are in the room with you and I right now, in the oak tree, or pardon me, in the acorn, there has to be the instruction set, the vibratory image, the picture of the oak tree. Because every time you put that puppy in the ground and you give it water and you give it light, it turns into an oak tree. Obviously, the instruction set is there if you know how to read it. So now here's Marcel, and he tunes the camera properly, and he can take a picture of the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. Now, if there's something in my life that I say, boy, I never want that to happen again. You know, like if I say to you, don't think about the color of your car, what moves in your mind? Through resonance, what moves in your mind is something about the color of your car. If I say, I don't want that to happen to me again, what energetic pattern is moving in me except that? And if these high energy waves are literally moving out from me, is that the creative wave? Is that what motivates somebody to be moving toward me, resonating into my space, and then doing a behavior that maybe they've sworn they would never do again? You know, how many have ever gone into somebody's space totally committed to being loving, caring, nurturing, and all of a sudden found yourself functioning like a mad banshee? It's like, what happened? Why did I go into that fit of rage with them? I was going in there to be gentle and nurturing and supportive. Well, here's what happened. There was a high energy wave emanating from their minds about being abused, and there's a high energy wave in your mind that matched their abuse. And that resonance set up, moved the energy in you of abuse, and perhaps against your own will and choice, took over as you spewed that abuse on that other person. Why did you spew that particular form of abuse? Because it was in you. Why did you spew it on that person? Because they were in resonance with it, and that interchange of energy resonated, activated that in you. And most people live their whole lives never knowing that their relationships are based on matching bags of garbage that people come together to spew, because when that energy moves in us, if we wake up, if we understand the point of this whole presentation I'm doing today, that what's moving inside of you is a reflection of what's moving inside of you, that what you're feeling is a reflection of that which is in you, then by becoming aware that it's in you and acquiring the skill and the tool of forgiveness, removal, you get to remove that disintegrative energy from your structure. And I'd offer that's the purpose of the world. The purpose of the world is to kick you right square in the limitation, to continuously hone in on, through resonance, whatever it is that's killing you, and give you the opportunity to forgive it. because life abhors us being diseased. So when I wake up to what I've shut down in me, what I've denied and dissociated from, I can now choose to move inside myself and find what I've hidden and remove that energy. Strengthen what I've hidden from myself through denial and resistance, the energy field of what I do not ever want to have happen again in my life, by holding that lie, by believing that somebody else causes that in me, then the likelihood of me resonating it into my space increases exponentially. Whenever there's something I refuse to be responsible for that I live in denial and dissociation with, I've set myself up for a repeated occurrence. Basically, the why is this happening to me again experience. Forgiveness is about accessing and removing denied and dissociated content. And that's what we're here to support people in understanding and acquiring the technology. Now, I'm going to offer, you know, this technology has been around for 2,000 years. How quickly did the technology of forgiveness disappear from the earth? Well, there was this guy named Yeshua, and he brought the technology forward. And then there's another guy named Paul who came along a few decades later, never met Yeshua. And this guy, Paul, is supposed to be a primo teacher of Yeshua's work. You know, he traveled all over, and he was, like, rocking. If you listen to Yeshua, the purpose and the result produced by the actual work that he gave people was they would live as love, and they would create a world of peace and health and vitality. Paul says, in a moment of his, I suspect, extreme frustration, why is it the things I would do, I cannot do? And the things I hate are what I do. And this is just a couple of decades after Yeshua put it out there and handed it to people. And Paul did not have a clue how to clean up his own energy field. And so he found himself driven by those internal unconscious dynamics I would offer to do things that he thought were vile, and to be incapable of doing things that he thought were wonderful and that he wanted to be able to do. If it left and disappeared that quickly, and it's been gone for almost 2,000 years, how long do you suppose you're going to have to hang out with it in order to understand it and bring it back? Well, if you've got the background and history in the brain cells, you might be able to do it more quickly than I did. I don't know. Except in 2,000 years, everywhere I've looked, I've never seen anybody who understood the technology. Pardon me. Anybody who's ever formulated it correctly and said, here's precisely how, on a consistent, persistent basis, you can go into your own unconscious mind, access the content that is there that has you doing things you hate, as Paul did, and disables you in doing things that you want to do. Here's the technology. Well, I'll offer that from the time I was introduced to it, I hung out with it full time, and I'm talking about full time. I'm talking about 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week full time. And it took me 35 years to understand what it means and how it's done. I don't know, you could go off on your own. Maybe you'll figure it out in a couple of weeks. All you'll need to do is have brain cells about psychology, psychiatry, brain cells about theology,
brain cells about physics, brain cells about physiology, brain cells about neurolinguistics, brain cells about how the brain functions, how the mind functions. That's all you'll have to have is those brain cells, and you'll be able to go, oh, here's what he was teaching 2,000 years ago. But you know, I've looked everywhere, and I haven't found one person in 2,000 years that knew how that was done. If you're not using the forgiveness process, we invite you to go to our website. You can do it live. There's a worksheet, step-by-step process. You can do it live right there on the website. You can print the worksheet off so that you can do it yourself at home. Or if you have a smartphone, into your app store, Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. Type in Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and you will be looking at the only forgiveness app in the world, which the genius of Miss Jeannie created. And thank you, sweetie, for all the, I don't even know, thousands of hours you put into understanding and then being able to put that into a format that anybody can pick up and use on a minute's notice. You don't have to spend 35 years. You can pick it up. There's the worksheet. Fill in the blanks, and that's it. Jeannie, I think, was talking about the fact that there was a book club that we did, and she put the video of that. I assume it's in the notes today. It's also on the website. But we took a young lady who knew nothing about forgiveness, and we walked her step by step through that worksheet process right from scratch. She was quite confused and didn't know what end was up with forgiveness. And so we were able to just guide her right through and into it. And she went right into some ancestral dynamics, a memory of her grandmother talking to her about some traumas that were matched the pattern that she was in, that had happened with an ancestor of hers. So, you know, there's an example there. And along with that, there are at least 20 other examples on the website. If you go to whyagain, whyagain.org, you'll see the microphone, click that, and then just drill down into the links that take you to the special radio shows where either Dr. Tim or Jeannie or myself have walked step by step with somebody through the whole forgiveness process. If you really want to understand it, listen to all 20-plus shows. Each one has a different nuance, a different question, a different slant, a different person doing a different piece of work, and each one of them contributes to comprehending how this process works. Start putting the pen to the paper and watch how life changes. I promise if you actually use it on a consistent, persistent basis, you will not end up like Paul, saying things like, why is it the things I hate are what I do, and the things I would do I cannot do? You won't be saying that. You will, in a consistent way, as you do your work, you'll be more and more empowered to do and say exactly what you want to do and say, and you'll be freed of the propensity to do and say things that you find yourself being embarrassed about or damaged or hurt. The technology's there. It's free. Go for it. Pass it on to somebody else. Our commitment is to make it available to literally every mind, heart, and being on the planet. Cost-free.
And Michael?
If you, yes, sweetie?
You have a hand up, and we're down to 11 minutes.
Okay, well, let me finish just one more thought or two.
Okay.
So download the app, and there are two different forms. There's a simpler version and then the deeper version of the reality management forgiveness process. Start to use it. Put it to work in your life. And support us. Find somebody, you know somebody who's in desperate need of the tools, pass it on to them. Inform them about it. Work with it, gain an experience of it, and share the experience with another. And or if it's impacting your life in a positive way, supporting you, go to our website. There's a donate button. Support us. We are doing everything we can do to make this as freely available as possible on a global scale. And aside from a very simple minimalist type lifestyle, everything that comes in goes into the next project of how can we make this available to more and more people. And join us for the book study, because that's just one more way we're going to be supporting people and putting it to work. So, Miss Jeannie, let's say hello to the hand that's up.
All right. It's area code 610. You are on the air. I believe it's Susan.
Howdy, folks. All right. We're going
Well, welcome, young lady.
I have a pile of questions. Michael, that was a great talk. And I have questions starting with a Delaware camera. Yeah, it was good.
Yes.
This is a nitty intellectual question. What kind of a picture of the oak tree did it show? Is it a generic oak tree, or is it the literal oak tree that's going to come to life if it's planted properly?
Well, my take would be that it's somewhat like perception, in that the frequency pattern that is in the oak is going to be reflected into a structure that it will ultimately end up becoming. And, you know, it's actually been years since I've seen these pictures, and I think Jeannie's got links on the website if you want to go read more about it. I mean, there's one set of pictures I remember looking at was a picture of a fetus in utero at 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and 6 months, and you could see the whole developing fetus. All four pictures were taken the same day. Now you say, well, how's that possible?
Holy
well, you know, at day one, does something go into the single cell that's been conceived and say, well, let's see, I need to put instructions in for day two, and then on day two say, oh, I need to put instructions in for day three, and on day 200 does it say, oh, I need to go in and put instructions? No, the instruction set is there; it just unfolds. And so, if you like the television signalist in my room, if I turn the television on, I've got the right decoder, I can see what's happening on ABC or NBC or CBS or whatever. And if I have the right decoder, which is what the Delaware camera is, I can see what that, which is in front of the lens, if it's tuned properly, I can see what it's going to become.
Wow, the implications for that, of that are huge. Like, for instance,
monumental.
Do we have our whole selves? Is it imaged right away when we're first conceived, and it shows us as an old person, maybe even a dead person? Or, you know, I mean, I'm not asking you to answer those questions.
Yeah.
My mind's just exploding with all the possibilities.
Well, my take would be that the whole unfolding process is there. Everything that will ever, that is structured into the single cell at conception, is there and available if we have the mechanisms to tune to it. Everything that's ever going to unfold in that person's life, except for if the being wakes up and chooses to originate as we're designed to do, then the being is going to write new information into the structure, and there's going to be a shift and a change. So, you know, at the age of 10, the child who's tapped into what their purpose is perhaps has changed their whole physiology. And if you took a picture of them at the age of 10 and compared it to the picture at conception, they'd be two totally and completely different things. And then maybe at the age of 30, you know, what energetic patterns have been added or removed, forgiven, that will change the outcome.
So free will is intact, thank God, and we can actually have an influence on what we become.
Absolutely. We have the ability to reach in, and anything that's structured and programmed, maybe from 20 generations ago, if we know how to access it, which is what first century Aramaic forgiveness empowers us to do, we can access it and throw it out of the structure so it never has to unfold. And if we have our imaging faculty, remember one of the faculties of the soul we talked about in the codependence intensive is the imagination, the ability to image in, to bring in a new frequency that can restructure everything. There's free will.
Oh,
now, of course, kings don't want you to have free will, so they're going to structure us with all kinds of rage and fear and guilt and grief, so we never wake up from it. We stay asleep and follow the program as inserted by the king.
You know, you go back into the scriptures and they talk about kings, and then they say, don't ever form contracts with them. They've been at this too long. They know how to run the game. Don't ever get involved with them, but find the power in you that was called Ruach HaKodesh that will, one, when you give permission with your free will to remove what doesn't belong, it will remove what doesn't belong, and then that power will teach you the truth of what's possible for you, will give you a whole new level of understanding, comprehension, capability, and change the game.
Wow. So,
and what if one of the frequencies that's there at conception, which is the frequency of death, what if death is just a frequency that's been put into the structure, and because it's there, we die? What if we learn to remove those death frequencies, those energetic patterns that don't belong, remove that overlay? Then what's possible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very high thought. I understand what you're saying, and I don't think I'm going to be able to do that in my life, but I love the thought and the possibility. Holy mackerel.
And if you insert it into your bloodline, who will in your future bloodline be able to actualize that thought? And will you be resonated right back into the bloodline to continue with the process?
Wow. Wow.
Now, I shared that back, probably 6 or 8 months ago. It might even be longer than that now. I don't know. Time flies. But I was doing a still point session, and I had this, my eyes were closed. I'm breathing away, and I'm inclined to point my eyes downward. And what I see is just this vast, unfathomable field of darkness with just throughout it small, tiny lights throughout the whole vast array of darkness and an uncountable number of small lights in that. And what I was told, what I was shown in that moment was that I was looking at my ancestry, and the darkness was the unresolved pain. And the request was, am I willing to be the conduit to access and process out that pain? And I agreed. I said, yes, I will do that. I spoke that to all of my ancestors. And interestingly enough, at the instant literally that I spoke that to all of my ancestors, I literally verbalized that out loud. My phone rang, and it was my son on the phone. Now, I've never had a conversation with my son about ancestry or, you know, grandfathers, nothing in that regard. But literally the instant that I said that out loud in my still point session to my ancestors, I will handle that. The phone rang, and my son was on the phone. He's, Dad, I'm on ancestry.com, and I need some answers about some of our ancestors. That was pretty good confirmation for me.
That was
a pretty powerful confirmation.
Amazing.
It's like, okay, we're on track.
Wow. Okay, that's amazing, and it's too bad we have too little time to